I'd like to welcome you this evening to the final lecture in our series, Astronomy of the 21st Century. This series is offered as part of the Winter 2009 LSA theme semester, The Universe Theme, Yours to Discover. And we're so glad that you're here and that you've been such a fantastic audience all through the series and through the semester. Thank you so much. I'm Amy Harris, Director of the Exhibit Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Gary Foreman, who's the president of the Student Astronomical Society. And together with the Department of Astronomy and the Michigan Center for Theoretical Physics and the University Activities Center, we together have put this series on and are pleased to have done so because it's been a lot of fun. We've had some really terrific lectures. A few events remain in the semester, and I'll tell you about a few that are coming up in the next few days. Tomorrow morning is Saturday Morning Physics. Oleg Gnedin is giving a talk. At the Ann Arbor Hands-On Museum this weekend, the Society of Physics students are working with the Hands-On Museum to offer family programming on astrophysics. There's a star party tomorrow night on Ingalls Mall and MLB4, weather permitting. And the Festifools Parade takes place on Main Street on Sunday from 4 to 5 o'clock, and there will be some planetary components to that. And then on Monday evening at the Exhibit Museum at 6 o'clock, there will be a poetry reading. This evening, following the lecture, there may or may not be telescope viewing. Maybe the clouds will part. Probably not. Are you going to do planetarium shows? Yeah. There will be planetarium shows at Angel Hall. So if you're interested in that, you can gather back where the students are selling astronomy T-shirts, which I think everyone should have. They're waving. So you might want to take advantage of that. And I'd like to ask everyone to silence their cell phones before we proceed. I'd like to introduce our speaker this evening, Professor Fred Adams. Professor Adams received his undergraduate training in mathematics and physics from Iowa State University in 1983 and received his PhD in physics from the University of California at Berkeley in 1988. For his PhD dissertation, Professor Adams received the Robert J. Trumpler Award from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. After serving as a postdoctoral research fellow at the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, Professor Adams joined the faculty in the physics department at the University of Michigan in 1991. Professor Adams is a recipient of the Helen B. Warner Prize from the American Astronomical Society and a National Science Foundation Young Investigator Award. He is a recipient of the Excellence in Education Award and the Excellence in Research Award from the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts at the University of Michigan. And in 2002, he was given the Faculty Recognition Award from the University of Michigan, and he was elected to the Michigan Society of Fellows in 2007. Please join me in welcoming Professor Adams.
Well, thank you, Amy, and thank you all for coming out on such a not-so-nice night. So today we're going to give a slightly different kind of talk. Most of the times you hear cosmology talks talk about the past history of the universe, and today we're going to talk about the future. So let me introduce you to the way in which we're going to think about it. We learned some centuries ago from Copernicus that the Earth does not live at the center of the solar system, or rather the sun does. And then later on we learned that our solar system does not live at the center of the galaxy, but rather lives somewhere out in the suburbs. Ever since this time, our status spatially has been continually degraded by these astronomers. We now know that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. It's the same everywhere in space, and it looks the same in all directions. So I don't have any control.
Well, I'll try it this way.
Is that better? All right. So, given that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, Our galaxy does not live at any particularly important place or any particularly special place in the universe. We're aggressively average in that sense. So what we want to do today is we want to explore the possibility that our time frame does not represent any particularly special time. And what I mean by that more specifically is that interesting physical processes will continue to happen. And by interesting processes, I mean those that will generate energy and entropy. But they will continue to happen almost as far into the future as you dare to imagine. And yet there's another principle that you might be asking yourself. It's like, well, is this just a waste of time? Is there some reason for us to study the future of the universe? Besides the fact that it's very interesting and everybody wants to know what's going to happen, there's actually a reason which we won't have too much time to get into, namely that by studying the future and the processes that happen over very, very long timescales, we actually learn quite a bit about how things work in our universe today, so we can understand quite a bit about astrophysical objects today by this exercise. But this principle will be in the background. So before I begin, let me introduce you to a new unit of time. Throughout this talk, we're going to talk about very long timescales. So I'm going to introduce you to the concept of a cosmological decade, which simply means this exponent. So if I define or express the time in units of years as 10 to the sum power, that power is the cosmological decade. Now, the one number you should keep in mind, not only for this talk but throughout your lives, is that the universe is currently has a finite age of 13.7 billion years. So one thing that's amazing is that we can actually quote three significant figures on that number, and nobody laughs, right? Although you guys just laughed. But also, in round numbers, it's about 10 to the 10 years. So we're now living in the 10th cosmological decade. When the universe is 10 times older, we'll be in the 11th cosmological decade, and so on. So what we're going to do is we're going to lay down a timeline of the future universe, which looks like this. We're going to begin at the beginning, and we're going to go through that very quickly. Before cosmological decade 6, there were no stars of any kind, and we were in an era called the primordial era. After about cosmological decade 6, and we're not exactly sure when this era starts, the very first stars formed. And stars will shine brightly from cosmological decade 6 or 7 up until cosmological decade 14. Remember, the universe is now 10 to the 10 years old in round numbers, so we're in the 10th cosmological decade. So logarithmically speaking, we're right in the middle of the second stelliferous era. In case you're wondering, stelliferous means stars, means filled with stars. If you look out in the sky, not tonight, but usually you see stars. And if you look at galaxies, and what you generally see is the starlight from those stars. In fact, stars are actually generating most of the energy that's being generated in the universe today. So we live very much in the stelliferous era. But this won't continue forever. If you wait a little while, namely 10 trillion years to 100 trillion years, all of the stars will burn out, and we will enter into the degenerate era. Now here, degeneracy does not refer to the moral state of the universe, but rather it refers to a quantum mechanical state of matter. When stars die, they collapse to very high densities where the wave functions of the particles provide the pressure. That pressure is called quantum mechanical degeneracy pressure, and these degenerate remnants, as they're called, run the universe of the future from cosmological decade 14 up to about cosmological decade 40. What happens at cosmological decade 40? Well, it's not a sharp transition at 40, but sometime around about then, and we don't know the exact number, the protons, we think, will decay. You notice that I keep using more qualifiers as we go further into the future. But all of the ordinary stellar objects will suffer from proton decay and eventually evaporate away. After that time, the only stellar bodies left in our universe will be the black holes. Now, usually you define a black hole to be something whose gravity is so intense that not even light can escape the surface of it. At this time in the future, black holes will be the brightest things in the sky. And they will shine by this process called Hawking radiation, or the Hawking mechanism, which was first discovered by a man named Stephen Hawking, who you've probably heard of. And what he's famous for is understanding that if you wait long enough, black holes will evaporate. And they'll evaporate until the last one is gone, round about cosmological decade 100. And then the universe changes its character yet again, and it enters into a kind of dark era, where, as my colleague once said on TV, it will be very, very dark. And the reason why it will be very, very dark is that there are no longer any stellar bodies of any kind. So for those of you with short attention spans, this is the entire history of the universe from beginning to end. Instead of ashes to ashes, dust to dust, it's really particles to particles. And in between, we have all this stellar activity that we're going to learn about today. So in the beginning, there wasn't a universe. So if I start at the very beginning, I can't actually start at the very beginning. I can only start when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old or so. And at that time, there was this high-energy fluctuating space-time foam, and somehow out of this, which we don't understand, our universe popped into being. Now, I'm being purposely vague, not because I want to be, but because this is the frontiers of physics. We don't actually know how this birth event happened. But what's remarkable is that shortly thereafter, after the universe is 10 to the minus 42 seconds old, we can actually pick up the story and say something sensible. What happens next is over the next 10 to the minus 35 seconds or so, the universe expands at an incredibly rapid rate. This is the inflationary epoch of the universe, and this paradigm was first put together by Alan Guth. Alan Guth gave our Ford lecture about 10 days ago, and you can see his lecture on iTunes. And since he is the master of this and it's already recorded, we'll leave that story to him. But what this does is it makes the universe big, old, flat, homogeneous, isotropic, gets rid of monopoles, and it provides fluctuations that eventually go into galaxies. Otherwise, it doesn't do too much. But after this time, the universe has a nice long period of expansion. And then we have another mystery. Sometime between this 10 to the minus 37 or 35 second mark and the time when the universe is a microsecond old, something very important happens. So I think it's time to do the usual experiment. I want you to touch the shoulder of the person next to you. And what you, come on, Gordy, do it. And what you notice is that nobody exploded, right? This is sort of a standard experiment. But what it means is that nobody next to you is made of antimatter, but everybody in this room is made of matter. In fact, everything in the room is made of matter. Everything on Earth is made of matter. Astronomers have sort of done this experiment indirectly all across the universe, and our entire observable universe seems to be made of matter rather than antimatter. And that's important. Well, one, it allows us to be here, which is important, but it also tells us something very important about the future history of the universe. Namely, there's some process that lets you get an excess of matter over antimatter. The physicist way to say that is that there's some process that violates conservation of baryon number. And what that means is that, well, we're all doomed. What it means is that the protons that make up us and planets and stars and everything that we consider ordinary in the universe, those protons can someday decay. Why? Well, because the proton has a lower energy state accessible to it. The positron is one. There could be many more. And if there's a way to get there, if you wait long enough, it will. But we know there's a way to get there because we're here. There's some process that violates baryon number, which means that the protons are not forbidden from decaying. So if you wait long enough, they will. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty in that that I'll come back to later in the talk. And we're only a microsecond into history now, so we need to speed up a little. But what happens next is that the weak interactions are continually making these dark matter particles come in and out of existence. And the abundance of those dark matter particles gets frozen out when the universe is about 1 second old. And then right after that time, it becomes cool enough for the universe to make light nuclei for the first time. So small nuclei like deuterium and lithium and especially helium are made from the time when the universe is 1 second old to when it's 3 minutes old. And it turns out that this early epoch of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, as it's called, produces all of the light elements, or the majority of the light elements, that are in our universe today. And it gives us the right abundance, which means that the abundance that we predict by Big Bang theory is the same as what we see in the sky. And that gives us some confidence that our universe really did go through this hot, early, dense phase that we call Big Bang theory. And that takes us to the end of the first era. We had the Big Bang, which is rather anomalously known. And then we have inflation. We have an excess of matter over antimatter produced. The quarks get confined into protons and neutrons at about the same time, or just after the matter separates itself from antimatter. Then we make the light elements when the universe is 3 minutes old. And then during this time, the universe is dominated by radiation, so there's this radiation signature called the cosmic microwave background. And we can see the signature of that in the sky today, which gives us further confidence that this story of the history of the universe has some credence.
And after that, these small fluctuations that we see in the micro background grow into large-scale structure of the universe. This is a nice picture produced by Gus Everard and his colleagues called the Virgo Consortium. And it's a picture of the whole universe. It's actually a simulation of a scale that's about halfway across the universe. And the reason why I like to show this is that I told you at the beginning that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, which means it's smooth. And when you look out in the sky, especially locally, you see stars, and the universe is very, very lumpy. So one question that always comes up is, how can the universe be smooth and lumpy at the same time? Well, the answer, of course, is that if you go to large enough scales, it looks smooth. And this picture tells you exactly how smooth and how lumpy this universe is. If you look at it without your glasses on, it's smooth. But if you look really, really closely, there's little knots in here of condensed matter, where this condensed matter is the size of a galaxy cluster, so 10 to the 15 suns or so. This is how big of scale you have to go to before the universe looks smooth. And these knots grow into galaxies, and galaxies collide, and we get more galaxies. And then in the galaxies, we get stars. And this brings us up to the present day. So if this were an ordinary cosmology talk, we would be done, because we're now all the way through the entire 13.7 billion years of history. But what I want to do today is start from this point now, where we are here in time, and see what happens next. We have the laws of physics, which we understand not completely, but to a good degree of accuracy. And we have a lot of understanding of astronomy, from the scale of planets up to the scale of the universe itself. So we want to simply ask the question, what happens next? Well, one of the things that we learned in the last 10 years or so is that we finally have been able to measure all of the inventory of the universe. So we think we know what it's made of. And it's made of matter and something called dark energy, which means an energy state that the vacuum has. And what this energy state that the vacuum has does is it causes the universe to accelerate. So I'm going to debut a movie for you, produced by students, of course, who do all the work. And this movie shows the development of large-scale structure from the past into the future. This little counter on the bottom, A, is the size of the universe in units of today's size. So I'm going to pick up the movie here when the universe is about 5 times smaller than it is now. And as the universe evolves, this is in a co-moving frame. So you're just seeing the biggest structure in the whole universe. And if I stop it, there. The universe is already 4 times bigger than it is today. And you see that there's still quite a lot of structure. But if I keep it going, you see that the movie gets more and more boring as you go further and further into the future. So if I wait until the movie stops, whoops, let me run it again while I talk. Come on. Oops. What I wanted to say is that here, when the universe is young, you see all this structure. But as you wait, all the structure gets stretched outside the horizon, and you're left with just an island. This is not just an island in that things are separated, but this is an island that things are so separated that not even light can get from one place in the universe to the next. So if I look at the stills from the movie, I have this. This is the large-scale structure. This is what the universe looks like 50 billion years into the future and 90 billion years in the future. And you see that everything becomes isolated, where everything is whatever's bound. So if I say that another way, every gravitationally bound structure in the universe today will become its own island universe in about 90 billion years. So in the case of our own galaxy, the Milky Way has a friend named Andromeda. And Andromeda and the Milky Way are a local group, and that will be the ground structure that we live in for most of eternity. Now, I said early on that studying the future of the universe tells us something about the universe today. So one of the questions you might want to know about the universe today is a seemingly simple question, namely, how big is a galaxy? Well, it turns out, if I go back to the previous slide here, if you look at the picture of the universe today, a galaxy is one of these little knots in here. And you ask the question, well, how much mass is in the galaxy? It turns out to be an ill-defined question. The answer is, we don't really know.
or we can't really define it at the present day. And the reason why we can't define it at the present day is that the galaxies are not quite done being formed yet. The universe is not quite old enough for them to have a well-defined mass. But if you run the universe into the future, each way you measure mass approaches a constant value. And the density profile of the dark matter halos approaches a constant form. And by using this, you can actually define what the mass of a galaxy is. So studying the future is not only useful, it's necessary if you want to define what the mass of a galaxy is. So it's actually useful for astronomy today. Now back to our own local neighborhood. I said that we live in a local group with a galaxy called Andromeda. And the cool thing about Andromeda, besides that it looks nice on the sky, is that it's coming right at us. So if we wait about a Hubble time, that's a time scale comparable to the current age of the universe, Andromeda will collide with the Milky Way, and here's another picture of it, and the beautiful spiral patterns in both galaxies will be completely ripped apart. So if you look at a galaxy in collision from the outside, it looks like a train wreck. But if you look at a galaxy in collision from the inside, what would you see? Well, it turns out that galaxies are relentlessly empty. If you shrink stars down to the size of sand grains, then there'll be miles and miles of space in between those. So imagine your friend a couple miles away holding up his sand grain, and you're trying to throw it at him. The chances are you won't hit it. In sort of the same way, when the Milky Way and Andromeda collide, chances are good that not a single two stars will actually hit each other. So if you could witness this collision, which would require to live for a billion years or so, what you would see is a gradual doubling of the brightness of the night sky. Now, perhaps more immediate concern is what happens to our own solar system. So to illustrate that, we're going to use what astronomers use called a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or a color magnitude diagram, which simply means I'm going to plot the power output of the star on the vertical axis and the temperature or spectral class on the horizontal axis. Where the horizontal axis is backwards, it turns out astronomers like to do things backwards. So the hot stars are on the left and the cold stars are on the right. So any star, when it has the right configuration to burn hydrogen into helium, like our sun is doing now, will live on this sequence of stars here, or this sequence of points here. And right now our sun is at point A. That just happens to be where it is. In about 3.5 billion years, it will be at point B. Now, that doesn't look very dramatic on this plot, but it's sort of important because it spells the end of life on Earth, which you may consider to be important. What it means is that in 3.5 billion years, the sun will be only about 40% brighter, but 40% is a lot. That's enough to run a real runaway greenhouse effect on the Earth. The oceans will boil and effectively sterilize the biosphere. Now, it might not be 3.5 billion years. It might be only 2.5 billion years. It could happen a little sooner. But the longest we have as a biosphere on this planet is about 3.5 billion years. Now, if you're the Earth, you don't really particularly care that there's these things walking around your surface. So from the planet's point of view, nothing dramatic happens at point B. However, about 7 billion years from now, the sun will turn into a red giant and get a little redder and a lot brighter, almost 10,000 times brighter. And then it will be at point C. At this time, the planet itself is in peril, as shown in the next slide, which I already showed you. What happens is that the red giant sun will grow, first overtaking the orbit of Mercury, then overtaking the orbit of Venus, and it will come out to the current orbit of Earth. Now, Earth, at the same time, will actually be slipping out to a larger radius because while the sun is expanding, it's also losing mass, and that lets the orbit of Earth try to get bigger. But while the Earth's orbit is trying to get bigger, it also has to plow through all that wind, and that causes a frictional drag term on it, which drags it back into the sun. So it's actually a little tricky as to whether the Earth will survive this or not, but it probably won't. So in 7 billion years, we have the end of our planet. Now, you might not consider that to be a very cheery thought, so there is hope. Stars pass by our solar system all the time. Most stars are smaller than the sun, and they're called red dwarfs, hence the name. And when a star passes by
our solar system, there's some small chance that it could save the Earth from this fate by scattering the Earth out of the solar system. Now, this is just one particular numerical simulation where the red dwarf star comes in and the sun, the Earth, and the moon all go in different directions. But you can actually simulate this and calculate this to high accuracy. What you have to do is do what's called a Monte Carlo simulation, where you do literally a million of these simulations at once, or not at once, but one after the other, where you have various binary star systems interacting with solar systems, and you mine all the possible parameter values, and from that you calculate a cross-section, which is the which gives you the likelihood of this happening. So what we can do is we can do bunches of these simulations and calculate the cross-sections for these interactions to happen, including the cross-section for ejecting a planet. And when you're done, what you get is you can calculate the odds of just about any event you want in a solar system. So, for example, if you want the odds of Earth being saved in the next 3.5 billion years while life is on its surface, the odds are about 1 part in 10 to the 5, which isn't real good odds, but it's about 30 times better than you winning the lottery. Now, the real big game state lottery payoff comes when the Earth is captured by a passing star. The odds of that happening while our biosphere is intact is about 1 in 3 million. And these interactions are wonderfully chaotic. So here's a particular interesting case where a binary comes in. One of the pairs of the binary takes the Earth away from the sun, but they still remain bound together, orbit about each other for a few thousand years. That red dwarf gives the Earth back to the sun, who then palms it off to the other red dwarf in the pair, who then leaves the dance with the Earth in tow, and in this case, in a more or less habitable orbit. And again, the odds of this happening while we still have a biosphere is about 1 in 3 million. Now, the reason why this is interesting is not just because it's nice that you can actually put an honest number on these kinds of low-probability events, but also that planet scattering of this kind happens in stellar clusters today, and it may be one of the reasons why we see the extrasolar planets with the crazy orbits that they're observed to have. So the same physics that we use to understand low-probability events in the future universe actually informs things like the planet population that we're desperately trying to measure in astronomy today. The other thing it does is it tells us something interesting. If you eject the Earth, you can ask the question, well, what happens? Does that actually do us any good as a biosphere? Because the oceans will freeze in about 1 million years. It takes about 1 million years, it turns out. But what's interesting is that the Earth has an internal energy source. There's radioactivity deep underground, and the amount of power we get from radioactivity deep underground is about 10,000 times smaller than the amount of solar power we get from above. So in everyday life, the sun wins by a factor of 10,000. You don't care that there's an internal energy source. But if the Earth is ejected, that's all you got. So what does it do? Well, any water that's deeper than 14 kilometers will stay in liquid form due to this power source. There's a bit of a problem in that our oceans are, on average, only about 4 kilometers deep. But any pockets of liquid water that are deeper than that, deeper than 14 kilometers, can stay in liquid form. So life on Earth, in the form of microbes, very deep in little pockets of water deep underground, can actually stay living longer if Earth is ejected than if it stays, by about a factor of 10, it turns out. Now, the other thing this does is it changes our debate about where life should be in the galaxy today. We have to put several pieces together to make this argument, but let's make it. If you want to have liquid water on a planet like Earth, you want to have liquid water on a planet that's warm. But the problem is that if you make a planet where it's warm, the rocks that make the planet don't have any water on them. So you end up with lots of dry planets, like Mars, although Mars has little water, it turns out. But you don't have a lot of oceans there. But if you make a planet in the outer solar system, then all of the rocks that make up the planets have tons of ices on them. So whenever you make a large planet in the outer solar system, it will have not just 4 kilometers of water like our Earth, but maybe 100 kilometers of ice. In fact, the Galilean satellites shown here have ice sheets that are about 100 kilometers thick. So imagine you make an Earth in the outer solar system. It will have at least 100 kilometers of ice on it, but only the outer 14 kilometers will be frozen because of this internal energy source. So if you ask the question, where are the most common liquid water environments across the galaxy, it's not like on Star Trek, where every planet looks like Earth. The most common liquid water environments that have an energy source are on frozen planets. So if you care only about microbial life, by far, the odds are best that life would arise in frozen planets. And I said in, not on, because it will happen deep underground. In fact, there is some evidence, at least, that life on our planet arose deep underground. So that lends further credence or importance to this possibility. Now we have to move on. So I'm going to move up to a slightly longer time frame than the Earth, or the evolution of the Earth and the evolution of the Sun. On even longer time frames, you can ask the question, how long can the galaxy continue to make stars? Well, gas in the galaxy lives in this sort of karmic cycle of stellar evolution where clouds make stars. They return some of their mass immediately to clouds. Only a small fraction of them actually end up in stars. Some of the stars blow up in supernovae and lock up some of their remnants in these degenerate remnants we already talked about. But the most of the mass from the supernovas then return to the clouds, and round it goes. But this process of star formation can keep going until the galaxy literally runs out of gas, because gas is the raw material that makes stars. And you can then ask, what's the longest that an ordinary galaxy like our Milky Way can continue this process? Well, as the gas supply gets smaller, the rate of star formation gets smaller accordingly. So these conservation practices drag this out. But even doing so, in about a trillion or several trillion years, the galaxy will be out of gas. And the last stars will be made through these ordinary processes. So hold that number in your mind for a moment. That just says the same thing, that star formation continues until the galaxy runs out of gas. Now let's ask the question, how long do stars live? Well, we said that our own sun will live for about 10 billion years, which is comparable to the current age of the universe, which is about 10 billion years. But the smallest stars live for far longer. So this plot shows that one of these HR diagrams again, where I'm plotting power output and temperature of a star. But this time I'm showing it for very, very low mass stars. And if you zoom into this little inset, it tells you what the timescales are. And the timescales here are measured in trillions of years. I made the label bigger for you. So when you make a star 10 times smaller than the sun, it will live for, in this case, 6 trillion years. So think about that for a moment. 6 trillion years is almost 10 trillion years. The sun will only live for 10 billion years. The smallest stars live for 1,000 times longer than the sun will live. This is also very profound in the following sense. Most stars are actually small stars. If you look at the 50 nearest stars, the sun is the fourth largest one. So almost every star in the sky is a little star, like the ones I show you in this diagram, and they will live for trillions of years, or at least the longest lived ones will. So stars will be active and shining brightly in our universe for trillions of years, which means that at the current time, when the universe is only 10 billion years old, we're only 0.1% of the way into the stelliferous era. Most of the stellar evolution that will ever take place in our galaxy or in our universe is in our future and not in our past. And another aspect of this is that as the stars age, they get brighter. All stars do that, because that's what stars do. And we can talk about why during questions if you like. But what that means is that as the high-mass stars die off and go away, the low-mass stars actually are increasing their luminosity and these, or their power output, and these two effects almost compensate. So while the galaxy is still able to make new stars, the total power output of the galaxy is relatively constant for trillions of years. And then once star formation ceases, it plummets. So the universe is going to be remarkably similar in the sense of being a bright place for trillions of years, and then it's going to plummet. And that takes us to the end of the era. So to recap, we've talked about the stelliferous era, where stars are running the show and dominating the energy production. But as you've seen, the lowest mass stars become increasingly important. And then also, if you look at this with a broad enough view, both star formation and stellar evolution come to an end at the same time. And what I mean by that is that the longest time scales you could imagine supporting star formation are trillions of years, And the lifetime of the longest-lived stars is also trillions of years. So when the universe is younger than trillions of years, you have lots of stars around. You're making new ones. The ones you have are still living. And then once the universe gets older than 10 or 100 trillion years, you're out of business. And then the universe just changes its character rather abruptly, which takes us to the end of this era and the start of the new one. The new era, of course, is the degenerate era. So let's take a moment and see what we have in our universe at this time in the future. Well, we have four kinds of objects that matter. We have brown dwarfs, white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes. Well, what are they? Well, most stars that are what you think stars should be burn hydrogen into helium, but they do not blow up at the end of their lifetimes. So most stars will turn into white dwarfs upon their death. And a white dwarf is what you get, what an ordinary star like the Sun burns out of its fuel and it shrinks. It will shrink to about the size of the Earth. When the electrons become degenerate, it will support it at that size against further collapse, and you'll have an object that just sits there. Most of the mass in the stellar population will be in white dwarfs, because most stars, from about 8% of the mass of the Sun to 8 times the mass of the Sun, will turn into white dwarfs after they die. Only about 3 out of 1,000 are big enough to blow up in a supernova when they die. Those stars will leave behind a neutron star. A neutron star is just like a white dwarf, except that it's a billion times denser. So you take a whole star and you compress it to about the size of Ann Arbor. And then it's at nuclear density, it's a density of about 1,000,000,000 grams per cubic centimeter. And then at that fantastic density, the electrons and positrons combine, protons combine to form neutrons. And the whole thing will be one gigantic nucleus made of only neutrons. So I'll have atomic number 0 and atomic weight 10 to the 57. We're in a chemistry block, so we have to. Now, some of the failed stars will still be around. That's what brown dwarfs are. These are objects that don't have enough mass to burn hydrogen in the first place. They'll still be around in the degenerate era. They're degenerate. In fact, that's why they don't turn on and burn their hydrogen, is that this degeneracy pressure keeps them from doing so. And finally, the largest stars, when they blow up, will leave behind black holes of roughly stellar dimensions. So I told you that star formation comes to an end. Well, I sort of lied to you, it turns out. Star formation will proceed through a different channel. These brown dwarfs are made primarily of hydrogen. Remember, they were made alongside the stars, and they're made of hydrogen, and they haven't burned their hydrogen into helium. In fact, they've sat around for half of eternity and done nothing. So they're the ultimate stellar slackers. Now, we know how many there are. We know what orbits they're on. And we know that if we bash them together close enough, like shown in the simulation, they will merge together and form a larger object. It turns out that most brown dwarfs are just under the threshold for stardom, so that if you knock two of them together, the merger product will be big enough to burn hydrogen. So through this process of brown dwarf collisions, we can make new stars, although at a very, very small rate. But we know all the numbers. We know how many brown dwarfs they are, how often they collide, and when they make these small stars, they'll be small stars that live for trillions of years, and we know how long they live. So we can put all these pieces together and ask, how many stars are shining in this dark galaxy of the future? Remember, our galaxy today is very bright. It has billions and billions of bright stars. This dark galaxy of the future will have 1 or 2 stars instead. And there'll be little stars with power outputs about 1,000 times less than that of the Sun. Now, at the same time, there'll be white dwarfs that are also orbiting through the galaxy, and they will collide at roughly the same rate. But most of the time when white dwarfs collide, since they will be small white dwarfs, nothing special happens. When the very largest white dwarfs collide with each other, however, the merger product can be bigger than a mass threshold called the Chandrasekhar mass, and the whole object can explode in a violent supernova explosion. So just envision this dark galaxy of the future. Instead of billions and billions of stars, you have 1 or 2 little stars. And then every once in a while, you have this violent supernova that punctuates the darkness. Now, the white dwarfs do something that's equally important, however. The galaxy is surrounded by this halo of dark matter particles, which interact only through the weak force. And the weak force is weak, so it doesn't do much in the universe of today. But as these dark matter particles whiz through stars, including the white dwarfs of the future, they will be captured. So over time, the population of dark matter particles will collect in the middle of these stars. And then you'll reach this equilibrium rate where the dark matter particles in the middle of the star will annihilate at the same rate that they're being captured. And this annihilation in the middle will give the white dwarfs a power source they didn't otherwise have. And the number is pretty interesting. It's about 1 to 100 quadrillion watts, which is coincidentally about the same amount of solar power that the sun intercepts from the Earth. So each white dwarf of the future will have about the same power resources as our Earth does, and there'll be billions of them. Now, collisions are rare. What's more common is to have near misses. So as these degenerate remnants whiz by each other, they will sometimes rarely hit each other, but they'll often pull on each other with their gravitational forces and change energies. So you basically scatter the stars off of each other over time. And over long times, some of the stars will be kicked up to high enough energy that they can leave the system. So if you wait long enough, the galaxy will literally evaporate. And it is very much a process of evaporation. If you take water and you wait long enough, the high energy tail of the distribution of the water molecules will leave the surface and go off into the air. And then the next ones do. And if you wait, I don't know, a couple of days, the water's gone. Well, if you wait, 10, 20 cosmological decades or so, the galaxy will be gone in exactly the same way. So the galaxy will only remain intact for about 10 to the 20 years or so. So what happens next? Well, the next big event on the calendar is proton decay. Now, proton decay as a science is in a rather awkward state. There are many, many, many channels that protons could decay in. And this science really is a science. Proton decay experiments are now in their third or fourth generation, depending on how you count. And we have hard experimental data. That's the good news. The bad news is that our hard experimental data says that the protons haven't decayed yet. More precisely, there's a lower limit on their lifetime of 10 to the 33 years, or 33 cosmological decades. So we know from honest experiment that the protons live longer than 33 cosmological decades. We have good theoretical reason to believe that they can decay any time from that time scale to about 45 cosmological decades. So that gives us a factor of 10 to the 12, or a trillion, of uncertainty. So except for this reckless uncertainty, we know exactly what's going to happen. And what I mean by that wasn't supposed to be a joke, but it sort of is. But what I mean by that is that except for the time scale on which this happens, we actually do know what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is that, well, there are many channels, and this is just one. So let me explain this. The proton decay event actually happens on the inner workings of the proton, which is made of quarks. So two of the quarks get together and form a positron and an antiquark. And the mass of this particle that drives this interaction determines the lifetime. So it's the uncertainty in this number that gives us this uncertainty in the proton lifetime. The problem is that the uncertainty in the proton lifetime comes in as the fourth power of this mass. But when this kind of event takes place inside a star like a white dwarf, this pion that's produced immediately decays into radiation. The positron finds an electron because there's electrons around, and that too decays to radiation. So the net result of a proton decay event will be to turn all the mass energy into radiation. And that will be locked up inside the star, which then leaks out of the star and makes the star shine. So the star will shine in the future because of proton decay, but as it does so, it will lose mass. And what it will do is it will look like this. So here's a movie. This really is a movie. Even though not, this is the opposite of the first movie. The first movie, all the action was in the beginning, and then it got boring. Well, in this movie, it's really boring from the beginning. Thanks, Jake. And what you're seeing is that the white dwarf is getting slightly colder with time, and the green part is the degenerate part. And now it's starting to get a little bit larger. See, degenerate objects work backwards. So as they lose mass, and here it's losing mass through proton decay, it gets physically larger in radius. See, it's getting bigger and bigger. Then it will turn yellow as it stops being degenerate. And once it's fully yellow, which will happen right about now, it's about the size and mass of Jupiter, but now it's getting smaller and it's going away really fast, and pretty soon it's gone. So the stills from this movie look something like this.
This is just a snapshot of the process you just saw. This will be the fate of our sun and the fate of essentially every star in the sky. And we know exactly how all these things work except for the calibration of the time scale. And that's what we don't know because we don't know the proton lifetime. But after that, all of the degenerate objects will be gone, and we come to the end of the degenerate era. So to cap off the degenerate era, we saw that the inventory here contains brown dwarfs, white dwarfs, neutron stars, and black holes. Star formation continues as long as there's brown dwarf collisions, and that will keep the galaxy populated with one or two stars at a time. At the same time, the white dwarfs are hoovering up dark matter particles and shining with about the same power output that Earth intercepts from the sun. And then the galaxy is relaxing or evaporating. So after about 20 cosmological decades, galactic disks and such will be so spread out that they're no longer galaxies. And all the same while all of this happens, the black holes will be getting larger. And then this entire era ends when the protons decay, which in round numbers we put at cosmological decade 40, emphasizing once again this number is uncertain. So after this time, what do we have left? Well, we have black holes. So let's take a moment and see what kinds of black holes we have. Well, there's basically two kinds of black holes, big ones and little ones. So in the middle of every galaxy, there's a large black hole called a supermassive black hole. These have masses anywhere from a million to a billion times the mass of the sun. This is exactly what Doug Richstone talked about in his Saturday morning physics talk, which you can see on iTunes. Every galaxy, in addition, will have about a million stellar black holes left over from the supernovae of the very, very largest stars. This is what Marta Vollantieri talked about in her Saturday morning physics talk, which you could also see on iTunes. So I won't say too much more about that. So this is what you get in the future of our universe. Each galaxy will donate one supermassive black hole and about a million stellar black holes. And these guys will be the main, most important stellar objects in this future. They will shine through a process called Hawking radiation. Since we have a little bit of time, I can now explain to you why Stephen Hawking is famous. I will explain to you why black holes must eventually decay. So in order to understand Hawking radiation, you're going to be required to keep three things in your head at the same time, okay? But only three, and they're very simple concepts. The first concept is one of a tidal force. Well, what's that? Well, if you're standing here on Earth, your feet are closer to the center of the Earth than your head. Now, you know that the force of gravity depends on the distance you are from the object. So, loosely speaking, your head is farther from the center of the Earth than your feet are. So, the Earth is pulling on your feet harder than it is on your head, which, as far as your body is concerned, is stretching you. So you can sort of feel the Earth is trying to take your head off. It's pulling you up. Now, Earth actually has pretty wimpy gravity, so this is not a large effect. In fact, you can't feel it. It matters a lot more whether you have a hat on or not. So it's not a big effect. But if you're near the surface of a black hole, by surface I mean event horizon, then things are extreme, and this is an extreme effect. So near the surface of a black hole, there will be an extreme tidal stretching force. That's the first thought you need to hold. The second thought is that because of the quantum mechanical uncertainty principle, there will be virtual particles, which I've drawn here. Well, what does that mean? Well, the uncertainty principle tells you that you're never sure quite how much energy is around if you want it to be around for a particular amount of time. In other words, you can violate conservation of energy as long as you do so for a small enough time. And that allows particles to kind of pop in and out of existence. And these are called virtual particles. Now, these are not just something that physicists made up. Sometimes you do have to worry about physicists making stuff up. But in this case, this is not something that physicists just made up. We see these particles. Now, we don't actually see them directly, but we see their interactions with other real particles in particle physics accelerators. So the fact that they are there is in fact a real existence. So there's a real existence of virtual particles. So we now have two pieces. There's a tidal force, and then virtual particles are popping in and out of existence in space all the time. Now the third thing you have to keep in your mind is something from high school physics, namely that work, which is energy, is force times distance. So now I'll put all three pieces together.
the virtual particles pop into existence. While they're in existence, the tidal force is acting on them, which means it's doing work on them. And the work it's doing on them is equal to its force times the distance over which they act, which is their wavelength, which is also the size of the black hole. So while the virtual particles are around, the black hole is doing work on them, which is giving them energy. If the black hole gives them enough energy, it can promote them from virtual existence into real existence. And that real existing particle can then leave the system and fly away. And it's that flying away particle that is the Hawking radiation, and that's the radiation that's emitted from a black hole. Now, you don't get anything for nothing, right? So something has to pay for that energy expenditure. And it's the mass of the black hole, and it's easy to see why. Well, what's doing the work? The tidal force. Well, what's the source of the force? The mass. So ultimately, the mass of the black hole has to get smaller in order for the virtual particle to be promoted to a real particle and fly away. So if you wait long enough, the black hole will be gone through this process. It turns out to be a long time. It takes 10 to the 65 years for a black hole with the mass of the sun to evaporate, and the time scale depends on the cube of the mass. So if I look at my inventory of black holes in the black hole era, a one solar mass black hole evaporates in 65 cosmological decades. Most stellar black holes will be about 10 times the mass of the sun, and they will evaporate in about 68 cosmological decades. A million solar mass black hole, like the one that lives at the middle of our galaxy, will evaporate in about 83 cosmological decades. The very largest black holes we've seen to date, with billions of suns, will evaporate in 92 cosmological decades. And even if a black hole is successful in eating its entire galaxy, it will evaporate in only 98 cosmological decades. And just to show you that black holes are not forever, if you take every particle, it turns out to be 10 to the 78 of them, in the entire observable universe today, and you ball them up into a black hole, that black hole will evaporate in only 131 cosmological decades. So because the universe is accelerating, and each bound structure becomes its own island, you cannot make black holes of arbitrarily large mass. And black holes of even these very, very large masses evaporate in about 100 cosmological decades in round numbers. So the black hole era will, in fact, come to an end, and we will enter into the fifth and final era, the dark era, when it will be very, very dark. Now, at this time, you don't really have any stars left, or even dead stars, or even black holes to play the role of stars. All you have are the leftover particles from these previous processes. So the universe really winds down in the dark era. But there's hope. One hope is something called a phase transition. What's causing the universe to accelerate today is this strange substance, which I didn't talk about too long, but I mentioned, called dark energy or vacuum energy. What this means, loosely speaking, is that empty space has an energy level associated with it. And if empty space has an energy level associated with it, it means, well, one of the things it does is it causes the universe to accelerate, thereby making every bound structure its island universe. But as soon as you say that the universe can have an energy scale associated with it, you can always ask the question, well, why can't it have two energy levels associated with it? Like an atom has two or more energy levels. And if you have a high energy level in an atom, it can make a transition to a lower energy level. So if the vacuum state of the universe has two energy levels associated with it, we could be in the high energy state, and there might be a lower energy state accessible. So what would happen would be a little region of space-time would make the transition from the high energy state to the low energy state, and then the bubbles of the new vacuum phase would grow, just like ice crystals in super-cooled water, until the phase transition completes. And the reason why this might be interesting is that the field that causes the vacuum to have an energy, which is the same field that is doing this transition, could be somehow coupled, which means it talks to the particles in some way, or the forces of nature in some way. So if this field undergoes a phase transition, the laws of physics could actually change. Now, at this point in the talk, we're getting to be a little bit speculative, so it's time to wrap up. But the one further speculation I'd like to leave you with is that everything I talked about is just what happens within our own universe. It's possible, and we simply do not know whether it is or not, but it's possible that there could be other universes and that our own particular universe is just one little island in this vast assemblage of universes that people like to call the multiverse. And if that's the case, then you may be sad that our own universe has gone through this transition from birth all the way to this dark era where everything's winding down, but you don't need to be sad because somewhere else in the multiverse, another universe will be going through that same life cycle. It just won't be ours. So this is a good place to wrap up. Thank you for your attention, and I can take some questions. So they said I'm supposed to repeat the question, so I will try to do so. First question. Yes. Okay, well, if I could hear you right, the question was, if I have a star, would it be ripped apart by the center of the universe? And the answer, I think, is no. Oh, I see. The question was, if you make a star now and the universe is accelerating, will the expansion of the universe and the accelerating expansion of the universe rip the star apart before it's done living and forming and doing its thing? And the answer is no, but the reason is important. Only those things that are at low density, which means they have relatively little gravitational force, are pulled apart by the expansion of the universe. Things at high density have enough gravity of themselves to resist the expansion. So if you ask how dense do you have to be before you resist the expansion, the answer is about the density of a galaxy or a cluster of galaxies. See, the density of space between the clusters of galaxies is so rarefied that the expansion wins and it stretches the galaxy clusters apart. But inside a galaxy, it's dense enough that the mass and gravitational forces in there can resist the expansion. So galaxies are not expanding with the expansion of the universe. They are what we call decoupled from the expansion of the universe. And they are just doing their things as if the universe was not expanding. In fact, they don't care. And when you go from the density of a galaxy to the density of a star, it turns out to be a factor of 10 to the 23 or so. So you're much, much denser. So stars really don't care that there's an acceleration going on in the background. But it's a very good question. Let's see. Yes?
At the end of your lecture, you had about the bubbles expanding. What is the definition of that bubble? What is it made of? What is the dimension? And also then the energy level, you said go to some other energy level.
Well, there's a couple questions in there. The question has to do with what I was trying to show with the phase transition that I showed. The way to think about it is that you're making a transition from one kind of phase to another. So the best analogy you can keep in mind is if you take water and you supercool it, and then you seed it with an ice crystal, that ice crystal will grow with time. So the ice crystal is a low energy state of water, and the liquid is a high energy state of water. So if you have little ice crystals in water and they grow, you make a transition from the high energy liquid state to the low energy solid state. The picture I was drawing is completely analogous to that, where the light blue bubbles correspond to the low energy state, like ice, and the other color of blue, the sea in the background, corresponds to the high energy liquid state, like water. So the phase transition proceeds kind of like you expect it to, just from that analogy. The next question that you asked was, what does it mean? And what it means is that the low energy state has a different vacuum configuration than the high energy state. Now, what does that mean? Well, the vacuum configuration can
can define the masses of particles and the strengths of the forces. The way in which it does so is something that we are currently studying. One of the reasons we want to turn on this accelerator in CERN, in Switzerland, is to look for a particle called the Higgs particle, which plays a role analogous to what I'm describing here. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's analogous to it. So the speculation is, and this is the most speculative thing we talked about today, is that if you have a universe that undergoes this phase transition, then the laws of physics could in some way be different in the new phase. And the reason why it's interesting is that after the universe dies, if it goes through this phase transition, in some sense it gets a new start because everything's reset. But since we don't know what it goes to, we can't really tell you what it's going to do. So let's go to another question. Yes?
Couldn't this transition have already happened somewhere in our universe already?
Well, that's a good question also. The question was, could this transition have already happened somewhere in our universe already? There's two things you could have meant. One is, could this phase transition have happened early on in our history and then pervaded the entire universe? And the answer there is, in some sense, it probably did, because the inflationary phase that I talked about in the first 10 to the minus 37 seconds or so is very much like this phase transition. But after inflation, the universe has entered into a well-defined vacuum state with well-defined laws of physics. And we think from that moment on history onward that no further phase transitions of this kind have taken place, not ones that alter the laws of physics in this way, because we can understand the history of our universe from then until now. The other question you might have asked is, could that bubble have nucleated on the other side of the galaxy and the bubble wall was coming towards us now? And the answer is, it could be. Because when that bubble wall gets going, it approaches the speed of light. The movement of the bubble wall through space, the way in which it sweeps up the new phase of matter, approaches the speed of light. Since if the bubble wall is going at the speed of light, it cannot send us a light signal ahead of us to tell us that it's coming. So you don't actually know. You will not know until it sweeps over the Earth. And if it sweeps over the Earth and the new phase behind it has different laws of physics, everything, including biology, will cease to work. So nothing will be here, or at least your consciousness won't be here, if it were to sweep over you. Now, you don't need to worry too much about this, because the time it takes for this this bubble wall to sweep over you is sort of the light crossing time, which is much faster than it takes to fire a single neuron in your brain. So you literally won't know what hit you. Yes, over here. Yes.
I would assume that we have some sort of mathematical model that shows that there's the possibility of a multiverse. If so, do we have any indication of how these other universes are evolving, at what rate, how they might be different from ours, and so on?
Okay, the question is, if you consider the other universes that I drew a cartoon of, and you're very much right, it was a cartoon, of these other universes, you're right. the question, though, is do we know how they're evolving? Do we know what they're doing? Do we know what the laws of physics are? And the answer is that we know very little. On the one hand, we have the theory of general relativity, which tells us how space-times evolve classically. And within that, we can design a whole bunch of different universe models, and that allows for pictures like the one that I drew a cartoon of. So there's a whole lot of possibility. As far as the question of what the laws of physics are in each of them, that's sort of what string theory is working on, but I think it's fair to say that we don't have any definitive answers. So we're working on it, is the answer. Let's see, young man right here. The question was, when you have virtual particles near a black hole, I said they fly away, why don't they get sucked in? And the answer is that they both happen. You have the virtual particles that pop into existence and they're stretched apart. One way to describe it is that one part of the pair flies away and the other part of the pair gets sucked in, because you're stretching them apart.
So the one that gets stretched away is kind of the one that goes away, and the one that's stretched closer is the one that gets sucked in. That's not a 100% accurate description, but that's as good as I can do here. But that's a very good question. Yes, back here. The question is, when the virtual particles leave the black hole, if they're just flipping it or flitting into existence, how does the black hole lose mass? Well, if the virtual particles came into existence and did not gain any energy, they would just go away. But while they're in existence, the tidal force of the black hole is doing work on them. That's giving them energy. And the energy that it's giving them has to come from its mass. So it's through a quantum mechanical and long-range process, the black hole is actually giving some of its energy to these virtual particles, thereby allowing them to fly away, and also thereby decreasing the mass of the black hole that's left behind.
How do we know that you can actually do work on a virtual particle?
Well, the question is, to repeat the question, how do we know we can do work on a virtual particle? Well, when virtual particles show up in particle accelerators, they behave in the way particles are supposed to behave. So we have some evidence that they're doing what they're supposed to. And tidal forces do work on everything else. So in some sense, it would be very unexpected if the tidal force could not do work on a virtual particle. But I could also answer your question another way and say, to be honest, we have not observed this Hawking process in action yet. This is purely a theoretical construct at this point. So we would very much love to have experimental verification of this. In fact, while we're on that topic, if you ask this whole picture of the future of the universe that we put forth, you know, how much do we believe, right? You could have asked that. And what I would say is that it's on fairly solid ground except for two things we would really like to understand experimentally. One is what the proton decay lifetime is, and two, what Hawking radiation really does. If we could experimentally verify those two processes, then the story that I told you would be on quite firm footing. Those are the two biggest things that we would like to know if we could do experiments to measure two things. So, way in the back. Yeah. The question is it possible to detect the other universes I talked about, and is it possible to get there? And the answer is sadly no. In fact, it's almost by definition. What we call another universe is something that we cannot communicate with, and if we can't communicate with it, we also can't get there. So these are purely theoretical constructs. It would be nice to visit other universes, but we just can't. Yes?
You discussed the half-life of decay of a proton and how it can illuminate a star, and eventually the star would evaporate. The half-life of a free neutron is known to be quite shorter. Would the same process be involved in the evaporation of a neutron star eventually?
The question is, would a neutron star do the same thing that I talked about? And also the fact that neutrons have a half-life that's short. There's two questions in there. Neutrons have a half-life that's short only when they're free neutrons. For the rest of the audience, a neutron will decay into a proton and an electron and an antineutrino in about 10 minutes. And 10 minutes is very short compared to 10 to the 33 years. But if you put neutrons in nuclei, they don't decay in 10 minutes. All the other elements on my wall here, a nice periodic chart for my visual aid, they don't have their neutrons decay in 10 minutes. So when the neutron is living inside a nucleus, it behaves differently and it does not decay that way. Now, when you go and you have a neutron in a neutron star, the neutron star is like one big nucleus. So the neutrons have different properties. The reason why the neutron star is made of neutrons in the first place is that the neutrons would prefer to be in the form of a neutron rather than a separate proton and electron. So they're not going to decay through that process that you mentioned. That will not lead to their evaporation. However, the neutrons will undergo proton decay. And what I mean by that is the quarks in the neutron will undergo a process that's completely analogous to the proton decay picture I showed you. So neutrons will undergo neutron decay of that kind, which is analogous to proton decay, on the same time scale, more or less, that the proton decay events do. So the neutron stars will do the same thing the white dwarfs do on the same time scale, with one difference. The neutron star is starting a billion times denser. And we saw that degenerate objects get bigger as they lose mass. So the neutron star will get bigger as it loses mass up to a certain point. Once it's too small in mass and too big in radius, it will no longer want to have its neutrons in the form of neutrons anymore. And then it will explode. Now, whether it explodes like a supernova, or whether it just bounces up to the size of a white dwarf, we don't know. But that's one of the open questions in this part of stellar evolution. We have time for a couple more questions, so let me take you there in the back. The question is, can I speak to the velocity of the universe now and when it was inflating, and what is the ultimate velocity? I'm going to have to rephrase your question. The universe is expanding at a well-defined rate, and the rate is not a velocity. Just like a length is not a time. So if you ask how far is it to Detroit, it's not 3 pounds to Detroit, right? It's 45 miles. So you can only ask a question that's in a certain kind of unit. So the expansion is defined by its rate. That's 1/1 a time scale, which is not a velocity. So there is no velocity that's an answer to your question. And I'm not trying to be facetious. That's just the way the universe works. But let me try to explain what I think you were getting at. The universe is expanding, and you might wonder, what does it mean for the universe to be accelerating versus not accelerating? And what does that mean as far as, why is it does the accelerating universe actually lead to isolation and these island universes that I talked about? To answer that question, again, you have to keep a couple things in your mind at the same time. When the universe expands, at least two things happen. The universe is expanding, so it's moving points in space away from each other. That acts to disconnect the universe. At the same time, as the universe expands, it gets older. As the universe gets older, light signals have longer time to propagate from one point to another. That tends to connect up the universe. So in any expanding universe, you have two things happening at once. You have a disconnecting effect because of the expansion, and you have a connecting effect because light signals can travel farther because the universe is getting older. So if you think about it, you really have two choices. Either you're going to connect faster than you disconnect, or you're going to disconnect faster than you connect. An accelerating universe is one that disconnects faster than it connects. In the early stages of inflation, the reason why inflation does all those wonderful things in terms of setting our initial conditions for our universe is that it is acting in this accelerating mode where it's disconnecting the universe faster than it's connecting up. So the story is that in the first 10 to the minus 35 seconds or so, the universe was disconnecting. So we started with the universe, which is all the same. Then we completely disconnected it. Then that phase stopped, and the universe expanded in the slow mode, where it connects up faster than it disconnects. So ever since the end of inflation, more and more of the universe is coming into contact with itself. It's talking to itself. So more and more of the universe is sending light signals from point A to point B and being in communication with itself. Then very recently, where recently means 5 billion years ago, in the history of the universe, it kicked into overdrive where it's now operating in this accelerating mode once again. So if that continues, and that is a bit of an if that continues, then the universe will disconnect from this point in history on out. And that's why we end up being in these little island universes that we talked about. So I have time for one more question. Let's see, I'll take you.
By itself, you have to have space and matter.
the question is, does time exist by itself, or do you have to have space and matter and all that? The short answer is, I don't know. But I can tell you something. In our current understanding of space and time, we use Einstein's theory of general relativity. And within that framework, we don't think of time as existing separate from space, but we think of space and time as existing in sort of one joint unit that, for lack of a better name, we call space-time. This does not mean that space is really on the same footing as time, but it means that what you mean by time does affect, or is affected by, spatial configurations, and what you mean by where you are is affected by time. So the flow of time depends on whether space is curved or not, for example. So space and time are related in a very complicated way through general relativity. But that's what they're talking about when they talk about space-time, is this interplay between space and time that's given to us by relativity. So I have one urgent question from the back, and then we'll close. Yes? No. The question was, won't the virtual particles near the surface of the black hole have to have a velocity bigger than the speed of light to escape? If you look at the picture, this will be the last picture we show. I go back through here. Sorry. You see that the virtual plot, this is supposed to be the event horizon. The event horizon is the surface where you need the speed of light to escape. So if the virtual particles were produced inside this horizon, you would be correct and they would never get out. So the trick is, and you hit upon the subtle part of this, right? The trick is you have to make the virtual particles show up just outside the event horizon. So if the particles show up just outside the event horizon, in theory, they can leave. They still need a speed that's close to the speed of light, but they can, in principle, get out. Now, in order to get out, they need some energy from somewhere, and that energy is supplied by the tidal force, which does work on them and gives them that energy they need to go. But the key is to make them just outside the event horizon of the black hole. If you make them within the event horizon of the black hole, it doesn't work. And what's subtle about this is that through the force of gravity, you're actually transferring energy, in some sense, from inside the black hole to outside of the black hole. But you're doing it through the force of gravity, which is the one thing that the black hole can do. In fact, that's really the black hole's only option, is to use its gravity. And it's sort of a quantum mechanical trick to steal mass away from the black hole. So thank you very much.